Hello and welcome to another episode of Politics Theory Other. My name is Alex Doherty and my guest today is Michael Hart. We spoke about Michael's new book, The Subversive 70s. The 1970s is often depicted straightforwardly as the moment when the radical movements of the 1960s fractured, failed, radicalised in ways that were self-destructive, and laid the basis for the neoliberal counter-revolution. In The Subversive 70s, Michael Hart argues that not only is that a much too simplistic understanding of the decade, but that it serves to prevent us from drawing important lessons and inspiration from the radical movements of the 70s that, he argues, are of more relevance to us today than the high points of the labour struggles of the 1950s and 60s. We talked about popular misconceptions about the movements of the 70s, how to understand the turn towards projects characterised by autonomy and in some cases armed struggle, and we also talked about why the emergence in the 70s of a multiplicity of struggles can be seen as a source of strength for the left rather than evidence of irresolvable division. Today's episode is brought to you by PTO supporters on Patreon and also by Verso Books, who have lots of great left-wing titles perfect for PTO listeners. One you might like to check out is A Short History of Transmisogyny by Jules Jill Peterson. There is no shortage of voices demanding everyone pay attention to the violence that trans women suffer. But one frighteningly basic question seems never to be answered. Why does it happen? In her new book, A Short History of Transmisogyny, award-winning historian Jules Jill Peterson takes us from the bustling port cities of New York and New Orleans to the streets of London and Paris in search of the emergence of modern transmisogyny. Weaving together the stories of historical figures in a richly detailed narrative, the book shows how transfemininity emerged under colonial governments, the sex work industry, the policing of urban public spaces, and the area between the formal and informal economy. Described by Sean Fay as a sharply argued work by a brilliant thinker and a vital contribution to political thought and organising around gender, A Short History of Transmisogyny is a bold new vision for transfeminism's intersectional and global future. A Short History of Transmisogyny by Jules Jill Peterson is out now from Verso Books. And now to today's interview. Michael Hart is Professor of Literature and Romance Studies at Duke University. He's the co-author with the late Antonio Negri of Empire, Multitude, War and Democracy in the Age of Empire, and Commonwealth. He is co-director with Sandro Mezzadre of the Social Movements Lab, and his new book, which was the topic of our conversation, is The Subversive 70s. In the introduction to the book, you write that what most significantly divides the progressive and revolutionary movements of the 70s from those of the 60s are their different relations to the present. Simplifying a great deal, the 60s were a crucial turning point that marked the end of an era. The accumulation of struggles in that decade, sometimes referred to as the Global 1968, included anti-colonial and anti-imperialist struggles, revolts against state socialist regimes, insurgencies against racial domination, industrial worker rebellions against factory discipline, and more, made the ruling global framework of power, as well as disciplinary regimes in each country, increasingly ungovernable and precipitated a series of social, economic, and political crises in the early 1970s. And you go on to say, we can certainly learn from the movements of the 60s then, both those that were victorious and those that were vanquished, but fundamentally they belong to a past world, not ours. The 1970s, in contrast, mark the beginning of our time. Could you briefly sketch out why you make this claim? What makes the struggles of the 1960s less relevant to our current situation? And why, in your view, does the 1970s inaugurate a new cycle of political struggle and pose political and organizational questions that you believe we still have to grapple with today?
Well, there are two ways of approaching the problem. The first, maybe it's the simplest to explain, but maybe the less important, you know, which is that it's not, I think they're relatively common explanations of the way that the forms of power changed after the 1960s. You know, the discussions of analyses of neoliberalism beginning, you know, perhaps in 1973 in Chile or with Reagan Thatcher, et cetera. The 70s is the era of the beginning of neoliberalism. It's also the era of the passage from Fordism to post-Fordism. You could say, in more general terms, a deindustrialization of the economic base in the dominant parts of the world. I mean, even the cultural terms about, you know, the question about postmodernism was really also about a real shift in this era. So I would say, on the one hand, you could say we're facing a different, not different structures exactly, but a different paradigm, a different arrangement of power. You know, I think that's something that is a relatively common thing to say. I think more pertinent to my point, you know, because I'm not as interested in analyzing the forms of power as I am analyzing the forms of organization, you know, of revolutionary organization or anti-systemic organization, et cetera. And there the question is somewhat different, or the demonstration, I guess, would be somewhat different. And the way I try arriving at this is to say that the political problems that movements of the 1970s identified remain our problems. And that's why, in some ways, they're most useful for us. So, you know, so you could say with the first one, they're facing the same enemy, you know, to put it in very short terms. And that's useful, but it seems to me, in a way, external reason. Because the internal reason is about the political questions of organization, about the need of articulation among different, let's say, strands of liberation movements. You know, these were problems that I would say were, you know, not unknown in the 1960s, but they were not prominent. They became prominent in the 1970s, and that's what the most relevant need for us to look at the 1970s rather than the 1960s.
And would you see the key reason that there needed to be that shifting orientation and recognition of what you describe in the book as multiplicity of struggles as being the relative decline of the industrial workers and their sort of leading position within struggle?
Absolutely. There are different sides to that question, because on the one hand, there's almost an empirical question about the way in which capitalist restructuring in the 1970s lowered the number of industrial workers in the dominant countries, and also shifted the conditions for industrial workers, in some ways, not exactly destroyed, but dealt a great blow to the unions of industrial workers. But more important, I would say, is the way you phrased it, which is that the centrality of the industrial worker in the imagination of revolutionary struggle. Like, I think it was, you know, it was relatively dominant idea, or, you know, not universal, because many groups struggled against this, was the idea that the industrial workers had to be the leading force for revolutionary struggle. There could be, you know, within that struggle, there would, of course, be questions about race, there would be questions about gender, questions also about migrants, the questions about the unemployed. You could even try to fit in, you know, questions about unwaged domestic work. But these are all under the idea that the factory is the center, you know, that, like, even the idea, you could, you know, this is almost a cliche of, you know, that revolutionary students would recognize, oh, well, we need to go to the factory, you know, either to support them or to become workers ourselves or something like that. That was effectively destroyed in the 1970s, or rather, okay, effectively destroyed. There are continuing, you know, strands of that. I would say that the conditions for that, in my view, were undermined in the 1970s. And for me, at least, rather than viewing that as a tragedy, I view it as a great opportunity for revolutionary struggle. You know, that, so rather than having a kind of nostalgia for the centrality of the factory, the centrality of its unions, etc., that we should see taking away that mandate of that centrality as an opportunity to, in fact, articulate in their full powers, other liberation movements that are, I would say, relatively autonomous from the industrial worker struggle. You know, like, why it might be an opportunity rather than just a tragedy.
On that point, I mean, just in terms of the number of participants in a given movement, would it therefore be your view that it sort of opens the possibility for a broader activation of much larger parts of the population than was possible even at the height of the workers' movement of the 20th century, which, as you say, was more sort of centered around the industrial workers, with other sectors playing a more subordinate, or perhaps one might even say a more passive role?
Right. I think you're right about that. You know, you'd have to say, so there was, you know, of course, I'm talking in somewhat general terms, trying to put together very many different movements that are somewhat times different in national contexts. But let's assume we can work in general terms, a notion of the centrality of the industrial worker, because it wasn't just that you know, wasn't only about the industrial workers' struggle. You know, when I'm thinking about revolutionary workers' movements in the U.S. And Western Europe during that period, it was the fact that the idea that they could represent the entire proletariat, you know, that they could represent the entire community, so that the industrial workers could, at their best, struggle not just for their own interests about wages, about work conditions, but also struggle for housing in the community or other social questions. It's not as if the industrial workers movement, and especially in its revolutionary forms, was isolated to the factory. But the idea that the centrality of the factory could be representative of the other is how it got its expansion. So in that sense, you know, one might say numerically, you know, just coming back to your question, well, yes, we were in those movements, we were representing the entire proletariat, but through the factory workers as the central and leading representative of that. Whereas once that possibility of representation seems to me at least to crumble, then maybe the numbers, you know, are more directly engaged the way you're saying, rather than having to center around industrial labor, rather, you know, that there could be, and this is what I'm, you know, most interested in, an articulation among anti-racist struggles that are struggling on their own behalf, and industrial, of course, worker struggles, and other elements of the working class too, that are not non-industrial portions, which have of course increased, but also then feminist struggles and queer struggles and other migrant struggles, that expansion of numbers takes place as an expansion of the protagonism. That's the way what seems key to me here. You know, the expansion of the protagonism of multiple streams of liberation struggle.
Going back to the difference between the 1960s and the 1970s. So in the book, you emphasize the relevance and the innovative and strategically sophisticated character of the social movements of the 1970s. But you point out that it's more usual for the early 70s to be described as the moment where the movements of the 1960s ran aground, were defeated, made strategic missteps, and descended into infighting and even a kind of madness. I mean, for instance, though it's not something you discuss so much in the book, it's very common in sort of pop cultural accounts of the time to see events such as the violence that occurred at the Altamont Free Festival during the Rolling Stones performance, and even the killing spree committed by the Manson family as being sort of symptomatic of this death of the idealism of the 1960s, or representing some kind of dark undercurrent to the movements. Can you talk about some of the standard accounts of the political movements of the 70s and where you think they go wrong in their depiction?
That's great. Well, let me try to separate out two, which I think are unrelated, but they sometimes both are characterized as this falling apart or internal destruction of the left. And one is about it goes under the rubric of fracturing. You know, I think this is a commonplace of referring to the left, that it fractured. And there again, a little bit like I was saying about the centrality of the industrial worker as protagonist, there too, what's often posed as tragedy, I see the other side as a positive development. I mean, but closely related to what I was talking about before. So like the, you know, what was often lamented by some at the time was, say, the way feminist movements were dissenting within the workers' movement or within other socialist movements. And similarly with anti-racist struggles, you know, that they were refusing to follow a program of unity, one in which they felt subordinated. And so that does involve a kind of fracturing, but it's right, you know, that in fact, it's a necessary condition for moving forward. So I would say, I mean, that's why I would try to pose the concept of multiplicity to recognize this positive possibility, you know, rather than fracturing, which assumes unity as the necessary condition for revolutionary struggle. Yeah, to put it that way. I think that's true, actually, now that I say it, with regard to the notion of fracturing. Yeah, so it's not, maybe this is something also that I'm taking more or less in summary terms, you know, from this development of the movements, which is that unity is really not the objective. If by unity we mean, yeah, a completely unified program, and certainly not a unified program under some sort of central direction. You know, I try to propose, or this is the terminology that makes sense to me, that articulation rather than unity becomes the objective. You know, so rather than being unified, there are relatively autonomous struggles, but nonetheless are able to articulate with each other. You know, so that a feminist struggles might not become the same thing as an industrial worker struggle or the same thing as an anti-racist struggle, you know, completely unified, but they can manage to articulate, meaning to struggle together, you know, put it in simple terms, you know, recognize the ways that the structures of power that they're confronting are also completely interwoven.
Just on the point about the way in which the trajectory of the movements of the 1970s is described in terms of fracturing and a lack of unity and so on, do you think that's somewhat understandable because the developing multiplicity that you describe is also occurring at the same time as a whole bunch of defeats that occur in the 1970s and progress even further in the 1980s? And of course, your position that it's actually possible that this developing multiplicity puts us in a better place for winning gains in the future is obviously a wager. It's not something we can know for certain, whereas advocates of a more sort of, you know, trad left position, I suppose, could say, well, look at the height of the workers' movement in the 20th century. We know the tools, we know the methods of achieving victories. We achieved victories back then. We need to recreate something of a similar movement. And, you know, I've even seen quite recently there have been some people sort of making the argument that a successful left strategy ought to involve left governments coming to power and prosecuting a sort of an industrial strategy for a range of reasons, some of them laudable, such as, you know, implementing a Green New Deal or something like that. But also because it would have the effect of recreating the industrial working class. And if we have a larger proportion of the population working in industry, then we can reconstitute some of the power that was lost.
Well, there are a couple of ways I should respond. But the first probably should be to question the Eden of this imagined past. You know, either whether that be the 1930s or the 1960s, or some other moment. So from my perspective, you know, recognizing any number of gains that involved, I think it's a misplaced nostalgia. It's a nostalgia for is not only, I would say, not only for the factory or the power of the industrial working class, but really a nostalgia for a time when the sides of our political struggle are clear. Like, you know what side you're on. That I think that in some ways, the nostalgia for the industrial working class and its politics is that. And because it's definitely true that beginning in the 1970s and continuing today, revolutionary struggle becomes ever more complicated. You know, complicated, messy. You know, with any notion of multiplicity is going to involve a kind of constant need for negotiation, for internal conflicts, etc. But that, it seems to me that facing those problems that we currently have, you know, let's call them the problems of multiplicity, just to put it in a kind of shorthand, to make that a nostalgia for the unity of, and now I'll be just give, you know, a stereotype, but something like, you know, the unity of the party that gives us the party line and that we are all unified in one message and we have a central protagonist that we can follow. That seems to me, yeah, I guess I would like to undercut what the, and also what the effectiveness was then. I think that's also, so there are two things about it. One is how lovely it was for us, and the other is how politically effective it was then. Maybe there's, you know, there's of course a third thing, which is that recreating the conditions for that seemed to me quite unrealistic, let's say. Recreating the conditions of the powerful industrial working class in the dominant countries today. Yeah, that doesn't seem to me a realistic possibility. But then, like I said, I don't think it would be an effective one, and I don't think it'd be a desirable one. So I guess on all three counts, that's it. I mean, you know, the Italians have a term, fabbricismo, you know, which is not, it's sort of factoryism, I guess it would be. And it is meant as a derogatory term towards those who idealize the factory. I mean, I guess here's another thing that looking at the 70s could help with, which is a lot of the workers, the most radical workers, and now I'm thinking, you know, it's also true in some of, you know, like in Argentina, but certainly in Western Europe and the United States, the most radical workers, A, were conflicting with their unions, and B, hated factory discipline. You know, so it's not like you could say, oh, for the days when all things were great and we had good paying jobs and we loved working in the factory and had strong unions, they didn't. So this, what was characteristic of the incredibly strong militancy of industrial workers, especially in the first half of the 1970s in the dominant countries, were wildcat strikes, were conflicts with the unions who came to accords with management that the workers refused, and the kinds of, you know, everyday refusals of factory discipline in general.
Another thing you point to regarding the conditions in the factories is just the extraordinary degree of violence and workplace injuries that were occurring in the 1960s and 70s. But on that point about wildcat strikes and the radicalization of workers, I mean, you describe this process in a chapter on workers in the United States, and you put it in terms of this broader theme in the book of the breakdown of mediation, where you have cycles of struggle where popular movements or unions will fight and protest and strike and will achieve gains, provided they don't go too far and they don't start to challenge the prerogatives of management in the workplace and the role of management in deciding how the workplace should be run, which you characterize as a more political demand. And you describe the thoroughgoing neoliberal revolution that happens in the 1970s and beyond that, which comprises the shuttering of many workplaces, the casualization of existing workforces, and offshoring of production and so on. You argue that the key reason for that was the radicalization of the workers that you describe and the effectiveness they had in starting to really, really challenge management. Instead of, as is the case in many other accounts of the period, focusing more on, you know, is this a crisis of capital accumulation? Is this about the falling rate of profit? Or was business simply opportunistically moving production outside of the United States and other parts of the global north in order to exploit cheaper labor elsewhere? Could you explain why you think that this response from workers, particularly from younger, often black workers, who, as you've described, started to really, really challenge the oppressive conditions in the factories and started to make those overt political demands, why is you think that that was key rather than those other factors?
You know, I can start with this in a perhaps unsatisfactory way, which is that, you know, this is true. I've been reflecting, you know, since my, you know, friend, co-author Tony Negri died a few months ago. There have been a number of commemorations. And, you know, one of the ways I've tried to reflect on his life are some of the common, you know, bases of our thinking together and of his thinking, you know, on his own. And one of them that we had thought of explicitly is about how, like, one way of posing it is that resistance is prior to power. Putting this in general terms, just that forms of power actually are quite, you know, conservative and reluctant to change. It's really workers' struggles, it's struggles for liberation that force that change in a variety of ways. I mean, we sometimes do it in philosophical ways about using Michel Foucault and Gilles Deleuze, but it's in the workers' tradition, you know, this is also something, you know, for instance, Mario Tronti, someone who was important for that, the Italian worker tradition that, you know, that Tony and I suppose I am part of, his way of posing it, the key phrase was that workers' struggles precede and prefigure the restructuring of capital. You know, so it's capital restructures as a, or develops even, you know, as a response to workers' struggle. So this is partly, you know, in some ways how I'm approaching it here along these same lines, you know, that recognizing that it was the workers' rebellion that made a certain arrangement of production untenable. You know, that you know, both through the practicality of the strikes, but then in an expansive way, the idea, you know, would be that the managers of capital, you know, that recognized that they had to change the basis of production. So a more material way, you know, that's a, whatever we call it, a principled approach, which is probably not very satisfying for someone, I'm convinced. What I try more in that chapter, in a more practical way, I suppose, or more concrete way, is to refer to studies about the management discourses at the time. You know, not just the, you know, often neoliberalism is conducted in terms of the economists, and that's great and everything. I think that this question really comes down more to those management studies of the need for transforming capital, and that they were, you know, they were cognizant of this, the threat of industrial workers' actions, especially industrial workers' actions that are not containable via the established unions. I mean, that's why, the proliferation of wildcat strikes pose such a threat. I would say, though, maybe I should come back to this too. I mean, it's not the factors that you gave before about capitalist transformation in the 1970s are certainly also, factors for the grand shifts that capital made rather than ultimately a cause. But like I say, I don't think that the adjudication among these different contributing factors, like the ones that you were posing before, I don't think that there would be any sort of whatever you'd call it, definitive resolution for which one is the most important. I'm trying to focus on the one that I think is most politically significant for thinking forward. Recognizing the ways in which organized workers had this power is in some ways a recognizing the historical transformation as something that, refers to our power, not to our weakness. I put it something like that.
In terms of the shift that was made, the very radical restructuring of the economy, would your view then be that absent the scale of radicalization and disruption and democratic challenge that elites started to experience during that period of time, that we wouldn't have seen particularly dramatic changes because they can live with a crisis of legitimacy which doesn't take active form, which if people are just sort of discontented, that's not enough to cause such a major change? And that also, because as you say, that's because of their innate conservatism and reluctance to experiment, they could also live with a situation of sort of relatively low profits, a stagnant kind of economy, and that it required that working class activation to trigger the much more thoroughgoing response.
Right. I think that's an excellent hypothesis, what you just said. I mean, posed it in very, coherent, reasonable terms. That was good. Better than me.
Okay. All right. Some of this has obviously already been touched on, but you describe how left movements responded to that breakdown of mediation with two strategies, although you're at pains to emphasize that in some cases, those strategies operated in tandem. The first being moves towards projects characterized by the concept of autonomy. And you write that autonomy is one concept that characterized the aspirations of a wide range of progressive and revolutionary movements of the 70s. Radical industrial workers, for instance, while taking control of their own struggles, declared their autonomy not only from the factory bosses, but also from the leadership and dictation of the dominant unions. Obviously, we've talked about that there. But you go on to say, the claim to autonomy was also a strong component of the many movements that employed the strategy of encampment, designed in most cases to block large infrastructure projects, an airport, a military base, or a nuclear reactor, by occupying the land for months in some cases, or for years, or even over a decade in others. Now, those autonomous projects, such as the encampments you describe there, are sometimes disparaged on the left for supposedly representing a sort of retreat from society and broader political currents, or being merely exercises in lifestyle politics and being characterized by an urge to isolate and create a sort of utopian community, which in the end has relatively little purchase on the broader society. What do you make of those kinds of criticisms, and why do you actually think the experience of the encampments is very important?
Well, first, I'll start with the specific, which is I would maybe agree with this critic. If encampments or when encampments become isolated from society and as if they were imagining creating some sort of separate utopia or at least a community. But the kind of encampments I was talking about were not at all that. So one that many people know about, of course, is the decades-long encampment trying to prevent the construction of what's now Narita Airport outside of Tokyo. And that was not at all an isolated phenomenon. People lived there, for a long time. They built all kinds of structures, many structures, designed to prevent attacks from the police. But one of the things that I find so remarkable about it is it's not its isolation, what you call its porousness to society. I mean, what it was primarily characterized by in general terms were agriculturalists, who lived on the land and who were preventing it, but then also with them, radicalized veteran students, mostly from the urban areas, from Tokyo in particular, who came to live with them. And so the kind of exchange between them, the kind of learning tactics, transforming each other by living together, that, it seems to me, not at all about isolation. That's about a a kind of meeting point and social transformation. I mean, I think that another I talked about in concert with that was this, what I referred to with that military base in the passage you wrote in Larzac, sort of in central France on a plateau where they were planning to greatly expand an existing military base, but then an encampment for a decade-ish, you know, stopped it. But it was a intersection point for all kinds of elements of the French left during that period. So it wasn't like, you know, even when later, you know, this is not then really, but later we've seen many encampments that talk about prefiguration. But I think, you know, there's a difference, I would say, between this notion of prefiguration in an isolated and separated community, and when it is in fact conducted in like what I was just calling porous, I'm not sure if that's the right word. I mean, I would say a social context. Contemporary encampments seem to be very similar to this. You know, all of the ones around 2011, you know, in Spain, 2013 in Turkey, the various occupies, I think that those encampments also had a kind of social, they became a point of attraction, you know, rather than an isolation. Currently in the U.S., this near Atlanta, this Stop Cop City, the large construction is not that different from Larzac in a way, except it's a militarized police now that they're creating a huge zone for that a large encampment is trying to prevent. There's similar ones in some ways in France. I think it's interesting that these practices of encampment, I would, you know, identify as having their roots in that period. And so they're in a way a kind of, you know, in some ways their stated objective is simply blocking something, you know, like blocking the construction of a nuclear reactor. But I think the actual practice of the encampment has many other ends that are not imagined to be the stated goal. You know, integration of different forms of activism, you know, their kind of encounter, working out problems of it. I mean, this is what Occupy was often about, recognizing the limitations of the movement and trying to work through them, that sort of thing. So anyway, I guess maybe just to come back to the beginning of it, yeah, I'm totally on board with the criticism that of encampments that end up trying to be a separated commune, let's say. But I think that the kinds of encampments that we've developed in recent decades that I'm dating from the 1970s here, I think are quite a different kind of phenomenon.
Just going back to the Larzac example in France, I mean, you described there how the radicals and students who had come from outside the area very much deferred to the local population when it came to strategic matters. And that was a population which was by no means radical itself. It was actually characterized by a certain Catholic small-c conservatism. Could you talk about that a little bit and the parallels you also see there with the Japan example as well?
Right. What I'm interested in there, you know, and I was just trying to, how shall we say, you know, tease out what the different groups were learning from each other and how they were being transformed by each other. And it's in some ways in general terms, there were, you know, a deference to the strategic aims of the local population, but then the local population adopted the tactics that they learned from the, let's say, veteran activists from, you know, coming from urban areas. And so this kind of mixture, you know, involved a kind of mutual transformation. That's what I was trying to get at with that. You know, I think one should say, or at least when I was a few minutes ago comparing them to our more recent encampments, what I don't find in these ones in the 70s, you know, there's certain kinds of mixtures, but they don't propose the problem of the multiplicity of movements the same way that we've done in more recent years. And I think that's an important thing that the more recent encampments have become, you know, so that, I don't know, I'm just thinking about the Zuccotti Park in New York and of Occupy Wall Street. I mean, there are certain conflicts within it, which I think were the right kinds of conflicts to be working with. Feminist conflicts with the ways things were organized, questions about whether the encampment was adequately addressing racial questions, et cetera. So I think this is something that, at least to my knowledge, was not a prominent thing either in the Japanese or the French occupations from the 70s I was talking about, but have become characteristic of our more recent encampments as a kind of point of encounter of the different strands of the most active political struggles today.
The second strategy that you describe that was adopted when responding to this decline of mediation was the taking up of arms to engage in direct combat with the state and with business, and in some cases, right-wing paramilitaries, or to use those arms to defend movements against increasing repression and violence from those quarters. There's a lot of quite well-known examples. The German Red Army faction, better known to many as the Baader-Meinhof gang, the Brigata Rosé in Italy, the Tupamaros in Uruguay, the Weather Underground in the United States, and so on. And these groups carried out very spectacular acts of violence. And those acts are often pointed to as being symptomatic of their strategic mistakes or the alleged sort of straightforward idiocy of left movements of the time, with their alleged tendencies towards a narcissistic portrayal of themselves as these valiant guerrillas in the style of much more successful and consequential third world liberation movements. And although you don't seek to defend their tactics, you argue that these groups have been somewhat unfairly pathologized and are described as if there was absolutely no strategic logic to anything they were doing, and as if they almost made this turn towards armed struggle just on a whim. So can you explain how in the book you seek to complicate that standard and very, you know, by now very sort of cliched portrayal of those groups?
Yeah, it's complicated. There are many parts to it. And I must admit that when I started this project, this was the biggest stumbling block for me, because it seemed to me, both in our historical memory and also at the time, that these left clandestine armed struggle groups were the ones that garnered all the attention and eclipsed everything else. And so in some ways, I felt like they represented revolutionary movements of the 1970s, and all the other democratic experiments that were involved many more people, and I think much more significant, were effectively eclipsed. And so it was hard. I felt like I had to deal with that first in some way.
I felt that a little bit writing my questions, Michael. I felt a little bit sort of like, maybe I shouldn't be asking about this because, as you said, they're more consequential things.
No, one has to.
And the whole thing has a certain kind of glamour to it and so on.
Yes.
Yeah.
It does. I mean, and that's important to, you know, to recognize the spectacular nature of their actions, you know, which gained so much media attention, but also attention by everyone. You know, so I guess I would, so here's one mode of approach, which is, like you're saying, I mean, I think at the time there was a tendency to pathologize them. And so it does seem important to me to recognize the logic, even when I'm in disagreement with it, of their decisions or of their strategy and also their tactics. So I guess one has to start at first with the repression. I mean, that the analysis was, and this is, you know, quite explicit by things that the groups said at the time, that there was no longer the possibility of getting reforms through peaceful protest. And so as police repression became ever more severe, and as it seemed that political protest was gaining ever less rewards, you know, either by industrial workers or by anti-war activists or any number of others, by the Irish peace groups, you know, before Bloody Sunday. I mean, there are all kinds of examples we have in this period of state repression that effectively demonstrated the impossibility of a kind of mediation that at least was thought to exist prior to that. So that one logic is about the repression, you know, like protest is no longer effective, therefore we need some other form of address. Okay. I think another strand that I found quite interesting, that it hadn't, before working closely with these groups, I hadn't quite recognized, is how much all of them are dedicated to, I would say, a moral indignation at the impunity of state violence and the history of it. You know, so a very interesting Japanese group that I didn't know previously, that called the East Asian Anti-Japan Front. You know, they're anti-Japan, but they're all Japanese activists who in some ways feel very contemporary to me. What they're, at least their opening strategy, you know, their early actions were all bombing symbolic sites of the celebration of Japan's imperial past. You know, that they felt the need to confront the Japanese population with the continuing celebration of its colonial and violent action. So, you know, like the celebration of war heroes, for instance, you know, war heroes meaning really war criminals of the Japanese army, that they bombed a site like that. I mean, it's not that different than tearing down statues of Rhodes or Confederate soldiers in the U.S. I mean, that recognizing or trying to demonstrate publicly the ways that these practices, you know, the practices of power in some ways of the past, but have an effect in the present. I mean, that's definitely true, and a continuation. Okay, so that, I mean, that's, I would say that this indignation crosses all of these groups, you know, of, and sometimes trying to exact a usually symbolic punishment about it. You know, like you mentioned the Weather Underground in the U.S., they also, you know, conducted bombings where there weren't, you know, where they were careful not to injure anyone, but they were always symbolic ones. George Jackson was killed by, and so they bombed the California State Prison office, or after Attica in New York, they bombed the New York one, or then they would, after bombing in Cambodia, they had a sort of symbolic bombing at the Pentagon, that sort of thing. So anyway, there was this, I think that this thing about moral indignation of and also a kind of imagined, at least, public pedagogy. I think actually this was probably not very effective at the time. I'm not even sure exactly how to study what its effects were to the general population, but they thought that they could wake up the national population. You know, these were also very national struggles in a way. The national population to the criminal and evil things that their state were doing. You know, and they were right, you know, that these were criminal and evil things their state were doing. But anyway, so that there was a kind of idea of that. I mean, I do think, though, that now maybe I'm stating the obvious, you know, that the strategies of a militarized struggle that was effectively separated from the movements because of the need for clandestine organization was a completely self-destructive endeavor, and maybe even destructive of other parts of the left. I mean, in fact, I would say, but this is the part that was clarified for me at a certain point, which is that the biggest destructive nature was really their own separation from the movements. It created a kind of political poverty of not, you know, here's also another commonplace for anyone engaged in a certain kind of political activism is, you know, you constantly profit from, you know, not only those who think like you in movement, but also those who challenge you. And that, you know, we learn as things go. And I think that their separation was, you know, necessary separation. You know, they had to live underground was part of their poverty. But let me go to one more thing, because it's like, I'm sorry, this is maybe the fourth aspect I'm trying now, but it is complicated in this way, which is that all of this said doesn't, I wouldn't pose it as a question of violence versus nonviolence, which I think was not primarily in these years a central debate. It wasn't a question about violence or nonviolence. It was really a question about how, and certainly there were other struggles that for me created a helpful alternative, let's say, to these clandestine armed groups that also had at least partial military organizations, but for the defense of the community and really the defense of what was primary for the movements, which were democratic, social, and political projects. I mean, the easiest one for, I think, listeners to, because most people know a lot about them, is the dual organization, I would say, within the Black Panther Party in the U.S., at least for a certain period in the early 1970s. Everyone, of course, knows about the guns, you know, and about the project for the self-defense of the community, which was, you know, a big part, you know, publicly about the Panthers. But equally important for the Panthers, at least equally, were their social programs, the free breakfast program, the free clinics, any number of other social programs that the Panthers were conducting. And, you know, of course, one should recognize the difficulty, and it's admirable they were able to hold them together, of these two strategies and even more practically, these two organizational structures. I also try to trace similar dual strategy in Italy in the mid-70s, you know, in the Autonomia movement, and then in a group translated as Revolutionary Path in Turkey that that I learned about and seems to have, you know, I has a similar kind of, at least in certain examples. I mean, in Turkey, the situation of violence was much more severe. The prevalence of fascist violence was very present, but they were able nonetheless, this is what I try to say, to conduct democratic social politics that were in some ways shielded by the use of arms. So this was helpful for me to say, okay, you know, armed struggle isn't all one thing. Armed struggle can have different modes. And so here it's just at a very high or simple level, I'd say, you know, these are forms of armed struggle that involve social engagement, you know, not separation from the movements, but a social, you know, being immersed socially, and that prioritized democratic social projects and in some ways held any military organization as a secondary element to it. That helped me in some ways to contrast with, you know, what I guess I'm criticizing the clandestine armed struggle groups for, to show that there are other ways of doing this. I mean, today, I mean, our more recent examples that I think, you know, most people would certainly know about are, you know, the Zapatistas and Chapas, the EZLN, they of course have a dual organization. I mean, I would say for them, the military organization is much more minor than the social and community projects, but nonetheless, they are an army, you know, at least they are in part an army. And then in Rojava, in northern Syria, in the Kurdish communities, they similarly have this, you know, attempt to, well, I'd say put it this way, the necessity of armed defense, they certainly have, and the attempt even in such situations of conducting democratic social experiments. You know, that's the kind of thing that I'm trying to identify. So, you know, I guess I went on a long way to try to explain how I got over a conceptual obstacle to myself, or found a kind of antidote to what seemed to me something that was kind of poisoning the entire spread of different movements. That was how I came to try to see what both I wanted to criticize and I wanted to affirm, I guess, in the questions of examples of armed struggle in the period.
On the examples that were most given to violence, as opposed to, say, Weathermen in the United States, which, as you describe, carefully avoided killing. In fact, the only people they killed were themselves in accidents when preparing their bombs. Presumably, the legacy of World War II is really key here in giving groups like the Red Army faction the license to operate in a more violent way. Because if you're in Germany or Italy or Japan, you know, you're looking around at your post-war society and many of the same people are still in control, right? And particularly regarding industry, it's literally, you know, former, you know, significant figures in the Nazi economy just continuing to do what they used to do, you know, maintaining their privileges and so on. And that must make it all too easy to think, well, you know, these are literal Nazis, let's kill them. It's not hard to see the logic.
That's a good point. Yeah, that's definitely true. I mean, like you're saying, in Germany and Japan, that logic about, you know, for instance, that there was a tragic bombing by that East Asian anti-Japan front where they targeted the headquarters of Mitsubishi with the argument of what Mitsubishi had done in Korea during the war, you know, prior to World War II. Also, you know, for a long period, it had enslaved peoples, et cetera. And so, and similarly, like you're saying, in Germany, and of course, also, this is something that the Red Army faction was very insistent upon, you know, that there were specific figures that they targeted, you know, and then kidnapped or assassinated who, you know, were Nazis. It's just easier that way. In Italy, it might even be clearer in some ways rhetorically, because the notion of the partisan, of the anti-fascist partisan, was really something that was reactivated. You know, it wasn't so much the Red Brigades, but other groups that named themselves as partisan struggles. So you're reactivating, like you're saying, the anti-fascist struggle. I mean, you know, as you say this, I'm not quite sure the right way to put it, but that's another context of the present. I mean, that we have to face in some ways, maybe it's a resurgence rather than a continuity of fascist, both specific figures and fascist practices. And And even having to confront, I mean, it's very difficult, I think, political question today, how much, you know, the term fascism is useful for some of the different reactionary forms we're addressing. But you're certainly right that that was, I mean, I think it's not today, and I think it's right not to be today, but that was certainly in the 1970s among these groups of clandestine armed struggle, the continuity with fascist Nazi imperialist past was certainly a very present, and combating them with arms seemed like the only way to address them.
Going back to the example of the Black Panthers and that pursuit of a dual strategy that you described there of both the use of arms, but also social programs, the free breakfast program being the most well-known case of that. You describe in the book how there was a gendered division of labor when it came to the two strategies. Can you talk about that a little bit and how that was a weakness for the Panthers, who, if I'm reading you right, in general, you are more sympathetic to than to some of the other armed groups that we've talked about there?
Absolutely. No, I was trying to think of all those ones that pursue this dual strategy as something that I think is more, well, was more effective at the time and more appropriate in as, I mean, not exactly a model, but something that we can remember if, when faced with such conditions today. You know, that I would say with the specific part that you were saying that, you know, that gender division is certainly not absolute in the Black Panther Party, you know, because in some ways, you know, Huey Newton was at a certain point seen as sort of the representative of the one most pushing the let's call it the social side rather than the military side. But there was, I mean, there were many criticisms at the time and certainly many analyses, you know, historically about the difficulty of gender divisions of assignment, you know, and labor within the Black Panther Party. But, you know, but when one says that, you have to recognize, of course, you know, they weren't the only ones. You know, it was more like a much more widespread hurdle, you know, that had to be addressed. So I wouldn't, I mean, I guess you could, there is a kind of mapping that's not wrong, you know, that has some, whatever, analytical effectiveness of the masculinist nature of the militarization of the movements, you know, the use of arms, etc. And that is certainly true, you know, and has a, like I say, a certain kind of effectiveness. The only reason I'm hesitating in this almost, you know, stuttering way is that one of the remarkable things about the clandestine armed groups in the 70s was the, what do we call it, gender parity within them. You know, the at least women in prominent positions of, you know, especially the Red Army faction, but also in the Red Brigades and in other, the Weather Underground certainly too. And so, in fact, what was sometimes the German press was really specialist in this, the horror of women with arms, you know, that there was a kind of cultural panic, you know, that at least reactionary press in Germany had both wanting to sexualize and demonize the images of Red Army faction women with guns. So anyway, I was just hesitating to give too much of a strict gendered reading to these questions about armed struggle and violence, because it's somewhat more common. I mean, I think it's a general, it's an important problem in general or even optic of beginning, but it becomes complicated.
Going back to the concept of multiplicity and articulation. So you write in the book that activists and theorists in the 70s formulated an analysis of power characterized by intersecting identities and multiple structures of domination. Capitalist, racial, imperialist, and patriarchal, which anticipated in some respects the notion of intersectionality that developed a decade later. Correspondingly, they forwarded a strategic proposal that feminist, anti-racist, anti-imperialist, and anti-capitalist struggles be articulated without priority among them. Now, many on the Marxist left would argue that although, of course, gendered oppression and racism long predated capitalism, that in both cases, they take these very specific novel forms under capitalism and are so thoroughly yoked to the process of capital accumulation that it makes little sense to suggest that there is something we could identify independently as the patriarchy, say. Can you explain why you would seek to defend the argument made by those movements of the 1970s, which oppose that prioritization of any particular struggle?
There are two ways to approach this. You know, one would be the, you know, almost a scholarly approach about the empirical reality, you know, of these different structures of domination and their relative autonomy or not, you know, whether, because the question you're you're posing in a way, I'm just repeating this part of it, is that although there are different structures in capitalist society, capital is prior to structures of gender hierarchy, race hierarchy, and various other social hierarchies. So one can approach it from that empirical and, I guess, scholarly frame. And maybe I should do that. You know, that's probably the more responsible response. But I think one should also recognize, and let me just pose this, I guess I should probably come back to the first, which is that strategically, in movements, that seems to me an utterly losing proposition. You know, to tell feminist groups, queer activist groups, that it's very nice what you're doing, but really the central struggle is elsewhere. And we can accommodate you within our struggle, but that's the way things are going to work. Like that is something, you know, that I think activists were reacting against in the 70s and since then. You know, that seems to me, it doesn't mean, of course, that there's another struggle that's the primary one. You know, it's not as if I would say it's an equally mistaken proposition to say that white supremacy, perhaps in thought of as imperialism, as the color line, something like that, that this is the primary.
That would be the sort of Afro-pessimist position, right?
Yeah, and that capital is in some ways subservient to it, or should be. Of course, capital is important, but it fits within this frame. I think it's a much more difficult proposition politically, but really the only effective one, in my view, which is to recognize the relative autonomy of these different structures of power and different forms of hierarchy, and to find ways to articulate them. I mean, in some ways, to recognize, find ways to struggle together. You know, not always, obviously, not always, whatever, completely in lockstep, something like that. You know, it might look more like a swarm than a, I don't know, an arrow. I don't know what the right metaphor is going to be. But that seems to me, and when one looks around, I mean, at least when I look around, these seems to me the most significant political projects today that are trying to face, as a condition of their existence, this need for articulation. Yeah, you know, the analytical question, which I was, you know, because someone could say, to what I just said, oh, okay, maybe you're right, we should pretend that it's that way, but the real truth of the matter is that capital is more important or something like that. That's what just come to mind are the different kinds of historical arguments that have been made in those bases. Like, you know, in the US, and this was probably true in Britain too, in the 1970s, there was a radical feminist response that said, you know, that was opposed to or really countered by socialist and Marxist feminists, but that said, you know, it's really patriarchy that's true, partly giving the evidence, like you said, it's been here for millennia, capital is relatively recent. You know, like, I would say it's true that you can take the perspective of any of these major structures of domination, and you can see the world from their perspective. I mean, maybe that's what I mean by the relative autonomy of it, but that doesn't negate the fact that you can equally do it from the other. You know, I think what we have is a kind of, what we have to adopt is a kind of parallax view that allows a kind of accommodation, you know, or negotiation, something like that, among these equally valid, I would put, views of the world. I mean, at least for me, it comes back to actual movement organizing questions. And partly responding to what movements are doing today, like trying to understand and explain why they're acting the way they are, like why every strike at a Starbucks, you know, you go to the thing and they're not just talking about the wages, they're not just talking about Starbucks, they're not even just talking about capital, they're talking about anti-queer violence and anti-race and racial violence and feminist questions. I mean, that's I would say that, you know, all, or at least the labor struggles that I'm most interested in are all taken along those grounds, rather than maintaining what you were referring to earlier, which I would call a class first proposal.
I suppose one thing that's very striking in your description of multiplicity and the relative autonomy of, as you say, of capitalism or racism or patriarchy and so on, is that it's perhaps very common on the left to think of capitalism making use of racism or making use of gendered oppression to, you know, achieve capitalist goals. But you suggest in the book that the opposite is also true, right? Capitalism has to adapt to patriarchy, it has to adapt to racism, and that therefore sort of reveals the relative autonomy despite the imbrication of the those different factors, if that makes sense.
Good. Yes. Yeah, that was a good point. And that was a better, in some ways, response than I was giving before, that could be one way that, you know, it doesn't, you know, somehow definitively prove that there is a relative autonomy among these structures, but it can suggest that when, just as you're saying, in equal measure, capital deploys gender division of labor and racial division of labor and these hierarchies within its own forms of domination, in that same way, patriarchy makes use of capital and forces transformations of capital that in some ways that similarly put it within the frame of the other. So yeah, I guess it's a proposition of multiple structures of power that are, you know, like not only interwoven and mutually constitutive, as, you know, the theorists at the time said, but like you're saying, that each deploys and makes use of the other within its own frame.
You've been listening to Politics Theory Other. If you've been enjoying PTO and finding it useful, please do consider rating or reviewing the show on Apple Podcasts. It really does help to bring in new listeners. The show's music and graphic design is produced by Planet B Productions. Thanks for listening. I'll be back next week.